You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/fizz24. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American power, politics and prejudices. The election is over, but the Americano never stops, and there will be a lot to talk about with the second Trump administration. And so we'll bring you more and more Americano, because judging from the feedback, that's what you guys want. So please keep listening. I am delighted to be joined by Michael Weiss, who is an editor at The Insider magazine, and our very own Owen Matthews, who is our Russia editor. Michael, I'll start with you. I think what struck most people about this is the speed at which it's happened. Assad may have been a brutal dictator. He may have been very, very unpopular. But as far as we knew until recently, he had a pretty sizable army, strong support from Russia, and that appears to have collapsed dramatically and suddenly. Why has it been so sudden and so dramatic?
I think historians are going to be studying this for years. If you had told me 2 weeks ago that the Republican Guard, the 4th Division, which are two of the most formidable or seemingly formidable military units of the Assad regime, would simply melt into the air. Damascus was taken without much of a fight. It was sort of given over to the rebels in advance of their invasion. It's extraordinary. To be honest with you, I don't know. I think we all kind of have to scratch our heads and wonder just how brittle, how fragile this regime was all along. But I want to get into sort of how this came to be, because it's quite interesting. There's a geopolitical sort of set of circumstances and a very opportunistic moment that allowed this to happen. What's been going on in the background, quite ironically, is normalization with Assad seemed to be a fait accompli. All of the Gulf Arab states had basically welcomed him back in. The United States, despite pronouncements by the Biden administration that this was their grand design all along, were actually making a series of gestures and diplomatic overtures, particularly with the United Arab Emirates, to offer Assad sanctions relief in exchange for his severing ties with Iran. I mean, everybody knows the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran, and its manifold proxies, including Lebanese Hezbollah, including Shia militias in Iraq. They were essentially the ground force for the recapture of so much territory from the rebels over the last decade or so, and Russia provided the air power. The one holdout, the one difficulty in this plan was Syria's relationship with Turkey. So Turkey has been very clearly one of the main power brokers in this civil war. They have recruited a consortium of different rebel groups, one of which is now very active in this current state of affairs called the Syrian National Army. I've described them as a kind of new janissary of Erdogan's sort of neo-Ottoman designs. But Turkey has one overriding national security interest, and that is the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which just so happens to be the tip of the spear for the American-led proxy force in eastern Syria that it was stood up in 2014 for the purposes of defeating the ISIS caliphate and keeping ISIS down and out. So there's been this sort of strategic contradiction in the West's approach to Syria all along. The Turks hate the fact that the Americans have empowered a so-called terrorist group in the PKK, and Turkey's plan for Syria, including its plan to try and normalize relations with Assad, was to diminish the PKK presence at Turkey's southern border. In the last several months, Turkey has been increasingly fed up with Assad's games. I did a detailed piece with Hassan Hassan, who is the co-author of my ISIS book, in New Lines magazine, sort of the TikTok of what's been happening and these sort of back channel negotiations between Ankara and Damascus, with Assad just simply refusing to play ball according to Erdogan's rule. All the while, and over the last several years, in northwest Syria, there has been a pocket in Idlib province that has been controlled by the aforementioned HTS. Now, HTS is headed by a guy, Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, who is now kind of the founder of the feast of this revolution. Abu Muhammad al-Jalani was dispatched by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the now deceased caliph of ISIS or leader of ISIS, in 2011 to go to Syria from Iraq to set up the ISIS franchise. It was then known as the as ISI, right? Because there was no, the S stood for Sham or Syria. They wanted to create a franchise in Syria. Well, Jalani, over the course of the Syrian civil war, broke with Baghdadi and kind of started his own show, became an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, and then pretended to break with Al-Qaeda for public relations reasons. But over time, the face grew to fit the mask. And there's actual documentary evidence that Jalani and HTS have gone to war with not only ISIS in Idlib, but also Huris al-Din, which is the actual new Al-Qaeda franchise there. So Jalani has kind of been this sort of strange figure, as somebody who started out as a transnational terrorist, and over the course of the last 7 or 8 years has reinvented himself as what you might call a jihadi nationalist. He's actually doing a state-building enterprise in Idlib province. Now, I say this with a mind that a lot of people in Western intelligence and the counterterrorism community simply don't buy it. They think that this is sort of just a psychological operation. Turkey, however, has kept HTS in place with its garrisons. There's a great deal of coordination at the intelligence level. I mean, basically, the border that Idlib shares with Turkey is controlled on the Turkish side, obviously, by the Turkish government. All the commerce and trade, money flowing in, that's been run by Ankara. In the last few months, as Erdogan has gone increasingly frustrated with Assad over these stalled negotiations, HTS has been champing at the bit, let us go on an offensive against the regime. All the while, the regime and the Russians have been bombing HTS locations in Idlib. And the Turks, all through the month of October, said, no, that will interrupt or derail our attempt at normalization. Well, finally, the Sultan sort of threw his toys out the pram and said, you know what? Have at it. Now, this was designed to be a limited offensive, to simply take some of the outskirts of Aleppo province that were under regime control. But what they found was every time they pushed, the regime simply, it didn't even collapse, it just disappeared. Syrian Arab Army soldiers laying down their arms, taking off their uniforms, donning civilian garb, running away. I mean, Aleppo, the city of Aleppo, which if you look at how the rebels first took it in 2013-14, and then how the Russians and the Iranians and the Assad regime retook it. I mean, this was one of the most pitched battles in the civil war. It was a Stalingrad. And HTS just simply blew in there in 3 days, almost without a shot being fired. And from there, I think they sensed the real vulnerability here, which is that there was no more regime. There was no Syrian Arab army. It just, as I said, it evaporated. And now, lo and behold, what, 13, 14 days later, these guys find themselves with the keys to the kingdom in Damascus. So it's sort of an extraordinary set of circumstances here. And yes, everything that's been happening in the world in the last year or so, Israel's decimation of Iran's project in the Levant, particularly the destruction of Lebanese Hezbollah, Russia's being bogged down in Ukraine and having drawn down at least some military infrastructure and assets from Syria for the purposes of fighting that war, and simply exhaustion, exasperation, both by the Iranians and the Russians with their client, or their, now I should say their now former client, Assad in Syria. So I don't think this could have happened at any other moment in time. It's sort of one of those strange concatenations of circumstances.
Well, one thing that it reminded me of, just in terms of the speed, was the collapse of the sort of Potemkin government in Afghanistan.
Yes.
And that was, we believe, orchestrated by external actors, China, possibly Russia, and so on. What you're saying there is that if there were external factors here, Turkey is the big player.
Turkey is without a doubt the big player. And I think, you know, the Turks now suffer from an embarrassment of riches because they did not anticipate the fall of Damascus. One of the ironies of all of this, or a potential irony, I should say, you know, I alluded to earlier that the reason the Turks are so keen to sort of wrap up the Syria file, as it were, is to get rid of the PKK, which has been empowered and enfranchised by the United States. They are very hopeful that when Donald Trump comes into office in just a few weeks' time, he will withdraw U.S. forces, about 900 soldiers in the Jazeera, which is eastern Syria. When that happens, I have no doubt the Turks plan to mount another incursion into Syria to try and clean up, wipe out the PKK sort of statelet that has been built over the course of the last 10 years or so. Now, however, because of the complete chaos and instability and uncertainty as to what may happen, I mean, are jihadis going to set up shop and start conducting terror operations abroad. This is everything that is preoccupying Western intelligence and counterterrorism officials at the moment. The U.S. might find itself in a situation which it does not withdraw because it's so terrified that ISIS might be able to take advantage of the power vacuum and reconstitute itself. So Erdogan's policy might actually end up backfiring because it was such a catastrophic success.
Owen, let's talk about Russia here, because a lot of Western analysts who tend to think bad for Russia is good for us. And there's a lot of, I'd say, not quite triumphalism, but something close to it, at Putin's humiliation here in Syria. And I mean, it is a humiliation for Putin, is it not?
Well, it's a humiliation, but it's, I think, more of a symbolic nature. It doesn't make it any less humiliating. But in practical terms, it's hard to say that, you know, what Putin actually really loses in terms of his, you know, practical abilities to project Russian power, because I think that's pretty flimsy anyway. Because the bottom line of Putin's involvement in Syria was really was an opportunity to cosplay a multi-regional power in the same way that the Soviet Union had been, while in fact actually expending a tiny, tiny amount of blood and treasure on the Kremlin's part. So actually, when you go back to 2015, when that intervention by the Russian Air Force was incredibly decisive, along with the Pasdaran, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards on the ground, as Michael brilliantly explained, the number of Russian warplanes that were in the that were deployed at Khmeimim Air Base near Latakia is one squadron. Literally 30 planes, 2,000 people on the ground, and ground staff. I mean, it's like it was tiny. If you compare, when you compare it to the absolutely enormous, you know, literally trillions of dollars that the U.S. spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's absolutely tiny, small beer. And yet, for that very small investment of troops and planes, there were also several hundred. I mean, arguably up to a couple of thousand Wagner troops on the ground, and so on. But anyway, it's very small beer. But it allowed Putin to kind of play the great regional sort of, you know, power, and, you know, on a par supposedly with Iran and Israel and all these other players, Turkey. So Putin's undoubtedly lost that. Although it's not at all a foregone conclusion that the Russians will not be back. I mean, supposedly the naval base at Tartus has been evacuated and the Russian planes have left Khmeimim. But I think the Russians are hoping that they're still going to keep a toehold there. So that's all sort of remains to be seen when there is like a new regime in place. So it's not clear that that's completely definitively lost as yet. But the bottom line is, you're completely correct, Fred, that it is a humiliation for Putin, and he has lost, you know, his ability to protect regimes beyond Russia's backyard and orbit is over. I mean, that's never going to happen in the foreseeable future. That, you know, Putin is not in a position to, you know, support regimes or interfere in regional politics anywhere beyond his own immediate borders. And even that is, in fact, a little bit in doubt, because, as we know, there's a chunk of his own country around Kursk province that is actually literally occupied by Ukrainians. So, you know, this is all a terrible consequence for Putin of the gigantic and war effort that has weakened, in fact, rather than strengthened, Russia's power in its near abroad and also, as we see, in its far abroad too.
To what extent, Owen, is it a defeat for Putin because he was invested, or he is invested, in the Shia crescent, that he had put a lot of diplomatic capital into relations with Iran? And this is obviously a defeat for Iran too, because it has lost something in losing Assad.
That's true. But on the other hand, again, as Michael very cogently explained, if Assad's own troops are not fighting for Assad, then, I mean, it's not really clear what the ICRG, what the Iranians or the Russians could do if the Syrians themselves are not fighting. And of course, there has always been a systemic problem with the Syrian army. And that is that it's, although it's Alawi officered, it's officered, you know, but essentially the ruling clan is Alawis, which is an offshoot of Islam. And those that is the minority that's been in charge since the beginning of Ba'ath Party rule in Syria. But the Alawis are in charge and they're the officers, but actually the rank and file tended to be Sunni conscripts. And you know, if they're not willing to fight for the regime, then, you know, even if Iran had not been so weakened and has been, you know, its proxies in Lebanon, in the form of Lebanese Hezbollah, not been destroyed by Israel, and even if Russia had not been fighting a disastrous war in Ukraine, you know, even if they were still firing on all cylinders, you know, it's not really clear what they could have done to really save Assad's backside, even if they'd been able to.
Michael, there's a lot of talk about a sort of reinvention of the Arab Spring. And of course, this is not, nobody, I think, no intelligent person is seeing this necessarily as a sort of blossoming of wonderful democracy. But certainly there could be another regime to fall soon after it. And a lot of people in the West and perhaps Israel too are hoping that that will be in Tehran. What's your assessment of that, given that we think Khomeini, I know he's been meant to die for a while, but latest noises are that Khomeini may be about to die.
You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/fizz24. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Prostate cancer, I think, but at his advanced age, it's slow going and he seems to be living with it. Look, everybody I talk to, from the intelligence community to analysts, say that the Islamic Republic of Iran has never been weaker than it is at the moment. What Israel managed to do, leave aside Gaza for a moment, because, you know, Hamas was a proxy of Iran, but it was a very localized one that had a specific remit. But Hezbollah was Iran's golden child. I mean, it was its prized asset in Levant. And in fact, one of the reasons that Israel was caught so off guard on October 7th is that Mossad, the military intelligence, all of their capabilities had been devoted to anatomizing the threat posed by Hezbollah. Right? If you go back to any point since the second Israel-Lebanon war, Hezbollah has been amassing an extraordinary arsenal, supposedly 100,000, 150,000 short to midterm range rockets that could rain fire down on Israel. And meanwhile, all the while, as we now know, several things happened. One, when Hezbollah was deployed to Syria to provide the ground forces for Assad's recapture of territory, that allowed the Israelis an enormous potential to go in and infiltrate the Party of God to such a degree that we now know the dividend of that, which was the now notorious pager affair, where they took out the entire kind of middle cadre of the organization by blowing up their bleepers all at once, right, through this very elaborate intelligence scheme. Hezbollah is completely decimated. Its Shura Council wiped out. Its Secretary General, probably one of the most influential figures in the region since Nasser and Saddam Hussein, Hassan Nasrallah, dead, buried under many tons of concrete thanks to an IAF bombardment. Once Hezbollah was defeated like that, and now that Assad has fallen, the IRGC project in the region, the so-called Ring of Fire, has been doused. And I think the Iranians begin to appreciate this themselves. I saw some U.S. media organization quote a senior Iranian official who said the fall of Assad is like the fall of the Berlin Wall. Rather kind of pregnant metaphor for the Iranians to be using, yeah? And also, you know, the Israelis, let us not forget, there have been direct exchanges, kinetic action by the Israeli Air Force in Iran, one of which, an overnight sortie, using fewer than 100 missiles, took out all of Iran's Russian-made advanced anti-aircraft system. So the question is, yeah, not if, but when there's going to be some kind of ferment in Tehran and beyond. And, you know, I think if you're Benjamin Netanyahu, your calculation now is this is what we're hoping happens under the Trump administration, because Trump is coming in guns blazing. Remember, the IRGC has put a bounty on Trump's head, or they've inaugurated assassination plots, which the FBI have interrupted. A guy like Donald Trump is not going to forgive or forget that very easily. The campaign of maximum pressure, meaning full enforcement of a sanctions suite from term one, that's probably going to come back. I think that the idea is to try and push and see what happens in Iran. Now, that could lead to its own set of catastrophic or unintended consequences. But I mean, reading the political situation here in the United States and also the kind of bilateral arrangement between Washington and Jerusalem, this seems to be kind of the play.
Well, I like your description of for Turkey, it may be a catastrophic success, what's just happened to Syria. For Israel, it's a catastrophic success in the sense that they probably wanted Assad to have some damage at some stage or to be weakened in some ways, but they probably wouldn't have wanted al-Jalawi to be in charge of the entire country.
No, I mean, I think the conventional wisdom to which I subscribe for once is that the Israelis preferred a weakened and predictable Assad in place to the uncertainty. You notice the movements they're now making in the Golan Heights, creating this buffer zone. They're seizing every opportunity to essentially fortify their own borders. They have been launching airstrikes in Syria to take out weapons facilities, including missile systems that belonged to the now defunct Assad regime, chemical weapons, which were meant to have been abolished under a deal brokered by the Obama administration with Putin many years ago. The Israelis, I think, are nervous, but they're also kind of cautiously optimistic because, again, there was a decision taken, I would say, halfway through the Syrian civil war. And I wish I could remember the Israeli official who gave this comment, which was the Israelis calculated that Jabhat al-Nusra, which was what HTS used to be known as, ISIS, the threat posed broadly by Sunni jihadism, was a greater threat to them than Iranian expansionism in the region. Well, that is very pre-October 7th thinking. And they have now recognized that Iran was really the sort of the great white whale. So I think what they're going to do is try to finesse the situation. And honestly, it's not just HTS that's going to be ruling Syria. The group that actually pushed into Damascus first is a former Free Syrian Army consortium known as the Southern Front. Now, a lot of the actors in the Southern Front were former recruits or assets of the CIA and Jordanian intelligence. Well, that's going to be a net gain for the Israelis too, because there's going to be a brokerage of agreements taking place at the southern border of Syria. In fact, one FSA officer, a former CIA hireling, gave an interview to Israeli media saying, "We want peace with the Israelis. We just, you know, we want to be left alone to build our own free Syria." So you can imagine the sort of skullduggery that is going to take place, and indeed, I'm sure has already begun now that the Ba'athist regime is no more.
Owen, Michael's alluded to it a few times, but if you think about the incoming Trump administration and the way they're going to be thinking about Putin, it was quite interesting over the weekend. I saw Trump in one of his tweets said something about, you know, this is Russia's. It was almost implying this is Russia's problem. It's certainly not our fight. That's quite an interesting approach for Trump and quite novel if you think about the way the Biden administration would have handled it.
Well, it's true. I mean, and J.D. Vance has been even more outspoken about this. Like, this is, you know, so not our problem. Just let them get on with it. I mean, what this all goes back to is there's a school of thought that had the U.S. in particular and the Turks not intervened and not backed the Syrian rebels, then Assad would have defeated them handily, you know, way back in 2012, 2013, and there wouldn't have been a Syrian civil war at all. And instead, this is a theory. I'm not sure it's actually the case, but there was definitely a school of conservative thought that said that we actually ended up creating the worst of all possible worlds for the Syrians, and particularly for the Syrian opposition. Like, we gave them, you know, enough weapons to fight on, but not enough to win. And of course, you may recognize that argument with several, you know, with the, you know, conservative voices have been saying essentially the same thing about Ukraine, is that actually, you know, we ended up sort of screwing over our allies by, you know, supporting them and encouraging them to fight and actually not, you know, giving them enough to win. I'm, you know, several serious Syria analysts that I've spoken to and read don't buy that. They think that actually it was the Assad probably could not have won, but it would certainly have been a different kind of war were it not for Western intervention. And also, we have to remember that, you know, regardless of whether the Americans had intervened, you know, back then, right? You know, this is back in right at the beginning of the rebellion, 2012, 2013. Even if the Americans had not intervened, then the Turks most certainly would have, because that is absolutely a vital interest. You know, the Kurdish forces that were you know, essentially in charge of. There's the whole sort of swathe of northeastern Syria around Al-Kamishli and so on. It's ethnic Kurdish territory up there. And but the long and the short of it is that I think that the Trump administration is considering very carefully whether America's job going forward is to actually get involved in everyone's wars all the time. That's actually quite a profound difference. That's a profound debate. And it's something that I think Trump has not taken a strong line on. But Vance, who I think, you know, has done much more deep thinking about this, but J.D. Vance has actually been much more outspoken about this new isolationism. And the first, and the first example is, you know, Vance has said, like, Syria, not our problem. The bigger question is how that logic sort of maps onto Ukraine. So, like, is Ukraine our problem? Well, kind of it is, but, you know, because if you believe that, you know, if you don't defeat Putin in Ukraine, then he's going to, you know, continue rolling on. If you think that that is Putin's agenda, then it very much is the Ukraine war is very much is the problem for the collective West and America at its head. If you think that it's just a local problem and Putin kind of has a point about, being able to, has a point about keeping Ukraine out of NATO, even if you don't agree that his methods for fighting against that were acceptable. There are lots of people in the Republican Party and lots of people around Trump that would say that actually, you know, we should stop these interventions, these sort of half-cock interventions that are actually creating much more trouble and instability than they're worth, because they're actually not creating secure outcomes and they're not really helping ultimately with American national security.
Well, and Michael, as you alluded to earlier, that the military presence in Syria then becomes crucial for the Trump administration in terms of what the Trump administration is going to do. And I imagine that the hawks within the Trump administration, Mike Waltz, National Security Advisor being one of them, would be very keen to bring Trump's attention to the potential terrorist threat that could be posed if you don't have a US military presence there in Syria.
You know, it's funny, I got off the phone just about 2 hours ago with a current U.S. administration official who was reminding me that Trump and Erdogan, Turkish president, have a very special relationship. They see eye to eye. I think they share certain personality traits. I suspect what will end up happening is the Turks will make Trump an offer to just inherit the file. And he may say, great, have at it. I mean, he did this once before. I can tell you that the people in the administration in term one had concocted this very elaborate plan for Syria. I was sort of colloquially referring to it as the Pepsi Challenge. They wanted to create the sort of free Syria that existed in the imaginations of those people who took to the streets and protested the regime in 2011 in the Jazeera, the sort of tribal heartland and indeed the Kurdish northeast, as an American protectorate and build up all of the infrastructure and all of the institutions that could not be built in Assadistan. And literally one phone call with Erdogan tore up the entire script because the Turks ended up invading the Northeast, the United States and its forces withdrew, and the Syrian National Army put to the sword quite a lot of Kurdish allies of the US, and this became this ignominious affair. Well, that was a foretaste of what will probably happen. I do suspect that the voices of isolationism, or simply the kind of pro-recessional element in this government, which is to say, the less America does in the Middle East, and probably everywhere, to be honest, the better, will win out, and they'll say, let the Turks sort it out. They're a NATO ally. You know, they already kind of have assets in place. They're running so much of the file. They have their own military forces now expanding a buffer zone in Syria, probably 30 miles deep. That's absolutely a viable argument for somebody like Trump. One other point, though, that I think is key. You know, I was covering Syria from 2011 during the Obama administration period, when the conventional wisdom was that there would be an intervention, a direct intervention in the form of a no-fly zone or a safe zone to give some respite to not just Free Syrian Army forces, but above and beyond that, civilians who were being driven out. Remember, Turkey got involved, and Turkey became one of the power brokers because they absorbed 3 million refugees from, you know, their southern neighbor, which had its own impact on populist politics in Turkey, including anti-AKP, anti-Erdogan political elements that were rising and threatening his authoritarian rule. All the while, though, what was very clear, or what became clear, was Obama had a very grand vision for the region, which is equilibrium between Iran and its sort of, you know, consortium of Shia pro-Iranian elements, including Lebanese Hezbollah, and what was then the sort of Saudi-led or Gulf-led Sunni states of the Middle East. So he thought, if we could create a kind of, you know, cold peace or some kind of balance between the two, that would lower the temperature everywhere, including in Iraq. All of that's come undone now, right? What that ended up doing was empowering Iran, giving Iran a sense that, you know, it could project its own power and hegemony throughout the region. And this was done largely at the behest of Qasem Soleimani, the now late commander of the Quds Force. I think his death in 2020 at the hands of the Trump administration, that was the sort of the beginning, even before October 7th, for some of the transformations we're now seeing and cataclysms we're seeing in the region. So again, one of the ironies of American foreign policy was we were trying to kind of make nice with the Iranians, you know, create a space in the region for the end of Pax Americana as we know it, and, you know, handing off more to the actual governments in the Middle East. And instead, it all blew up in our face. And now we find ourselves, as I said earlier, Iran severely on the back foot and sort of rising new elements and powers, including Turkey, which, I mean, if you want to be a bit crude about it, you could say has a sort of neo-Ottoman design for the region. I mean, Erdogan is going to be, you know, he's a sultan, and he's certainly behaving like such now.
Michael, I think it's generally agreed now that America's invasion of Iraq was a strategic disaster. And one of the main beneficiaries of that disaster was Iran. Now that Syria is imploding, that will be the tension within foreign policy think world in Washington, D.C., as to whether America's better off leaving it alone because Iran seems to be failing all by itself without a lot of American pressure.
I think that's certainly a viewpoint. And yeah, I mean, look, Syria is a Sunni majority country that had been run by the Alawite minority for 50 years. It will be Sunni majority run now. The government is very clearly going to, you know, consist of the ethnic majority as in whatever form of consensus politics takes place. That's put Iran in a very awkward spot. You notice what's happening in Iraq as well. You know, so in the dying days of the Assad regime, which, God, it was only a few days ago, there was an outreach everywhere, including to the Iraqi government in Baghdad, because when ISIS blew into Mosul in 2014, one of the biggest calls to rally the nation of Iraq, which was also done by the IRGC, was to create the Hashd al-Shaabi, which is this sort of enterprising group of Shia militias. Many of them are simply wholly owned subsidiaries of the Quds Force. The Hashd have become an overweening entity unto themselves. They're responsible for atrocities, not just against Sunni civilians, but also against Iraqi Shia who don't bend to their will. Well, they didn't come in. They weren't the cavalry that saved Assad, because the Iranians and the Iraqis took a decision. This is your affair. You know, you made this mess in Syria. You cleaned it up. There's also now new elements in Iraqi politics, actually new old elements in Iraqi politics. Muqtada al-Sadr, another, you know, big Shia warlord and commander of his own militia. He was very clear at the outset, we're not going to intervene in Syria. I mean, he is also in a rather Jolani-like manner, reinvented himself as more of a nationalist figure in Shia jihadism rather than the Sunni variety. So I think, yeah, there are several contradictions at play here in terms of what Iran has managed to do over the last 20 years in Iraq. I mean, Iraqi Kurds are telling me that the minute that the Trump administration starts imposing sanctions, particularly enforcing sanctions with respect to Iraqi banking and sort of the rampant corruption that's taken place, you know, under the Biden administration's purview in Iraq and its government institutions, that this is going to lead to a crisis. So we could well see the beginning of the end of the Islamic Republic start in Iraq, which is its now, you know, its most prized possession, the only one really it's got left at the moment. But yes, I mean, there's no question, you know, the Bush administration's sort of utopian design was you get rid of Saddam and you get rid of all three tiers of the Ba'ath Party, which had kept the country sort of running. And we will create this American protectorate. We will have this sort of beachhead of democracy in the region, and that will spread like wildfire. And it was such a not a catastrophic success, as I mentioned, what happened in Syria under, you know, Turkish designs, but a catastrophic failure that we ended up giving Iraq on a silver platter. And so the question is now, you know, where does America go forward? If it simply wipes its hands of the region or tries to, is that going to create a mess, or is that going to create a sort of spiraling series of events that, you know, blows back at us? Or will things actually find their natural level? Accommodations will be reached. And honestly, I mean, this is something that people who were very gung-ho about the invasion of Iraq have belatedly resigned themselves to, that they were wrong and it's best for America to do far less, because the net effect is less worse than what would otherwise be.
It's very interesting what you're saying about these jihadist figures reinventing themselves as nationalists. Is the possibility then that we might be having a sort of a Ba'athist moment, but a jihadist version of it, therefore the Muslim Brotherhood, a kind of Muslim Brotherhood view of how countries can be run, of how power can work in the region, might prevail?
Well, you know, this is one of the unforeseen developments of the war on terror. You know, my colleague Hassan wrote a piece about this several years ago, actually, upon the U.S. withdrawal of Afghanistan and the takeover by the Taliban. And that is, the jihadist groups didn't go away. They weren't bombed into oblivion, as everyone thought that they might be. They simply realized that the juice ain't worth the squeeze, as we say here in the States, in terms of if we start exporting violence and our, you know, sort of obscurantist Islamist views abroad and invite major powers, Western governments, non-Western governments in some cases, to come in and destroy our countries and to wipe out our leadership and to embroil us in civil wars, this is a known goal for us. It's much better, much wiser to stay put in our own borders, not do transnational terrorism, and to build a state. And this is indeed, I mean, this was the key insight Jolani had. And by the way, I mean, he's modeling his approach, including his outreach to hostile foreign governments, such as the United States, on what the Taliban managed to achieve over the last several years. And isn't it interesting? In July, Putin said that the Taliban now is the de facto government of Afghanistan, and they are our ally in counterterrorism, because the Taliban is at war with which organization? ISIS-K, which has been responsible for a series of grisly bombings in Russia, including the Crocus Mall one from several months ago. So Jolani is pushing himself, he's angling himself to be a partner in combating transnational terror, with not only the West, but also the Gulf Arab states who hold him in deep suspicion, especially the Emiratis, the Iraqis, and possibly even the Russians. I mean, there could be a deal struck between HJS and Moscow. In fact, the Russian press is saying that they have offered our forces safe passage out of, you know, the hot zone, and that there's so far no attacks on our naval base in Tartus or our airfield in Latakia. So yes, I think that point is worth making, that even jihadis learn that it's necessary to evolve, lest they, you know, they perish or they lose the constituency that they require to take power.
So perhaps along those lines, Western analysts saying this is a great humiliation for Putin are speaking far too soon, because in fact, Russia may be able to operate even more successfully with a new Syria government and or even perhaps a failed Syrian government.
One thing that that has happened since Russia intervened in Syria in 2015 is they do use their perch in Syria as a kind of, you know, midway point for operations in Africa. So, you know, Africa Corps, their interventions in places like Mali, Libya, et cetera. These jets are often resupplying in Latakia or taking off from Latakia, picking up payloads, et cetera. So that's something that they I don't think want to squander. And if they can cut some kind of arrangement with HTS to leave, you know, some sliver of influence in that sort of coastal littoral that is where, you know, the rebels don't have a complete hold on power yet. HTS would prefer that probably to getting bombed round the clock, right? Again, they're very interested in building up what they've spent the last 7 or 8 years doing in Idlib and expanding that throughout the country. Now, again, I don't say this to sort of endorse this project. I'm just describing the state of affairs. And that what they're intending is fraught with all kinds of possibilities for just complete horror, right? I mean, jihadis coming in, being given safe haven, or simply exploiting the internal dynamics in Syria. As I mentioned, this is, you know, HTS does not have complete control over the country. And a good one third of the country, if not more, is still under an American protectorate with a very vulnerable and very ambitious ethnic minority population in the Kurds. So,
well, lots of fascinating dynamics at play. Michael, thank you so much for coming on to Spectator TV to talk to us about it. And thank you, Owen. Thank you very much for listening to that episode of The Americano Show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave rave reviews on whatever platform you listen to it on. I would like to thank, of course, my brilliant producer, Natasha Feroz. Thanks again for listening. All the best.